And welcome to the fourth episode of, oh no, it's the Ranieri Brothers with your hosts, me, Thomas Ranieri, and my brother, Benjamin Ranieri.
Hello.
Hello. And this time we're going to be, this podcast, we're going to be talking about actually getting down to the nitty gritty on business in a small town. As we talked about in the first podcast, making it big in a small town. And specifically, we're going to be touching on things like networking and bigger projects and the current availability of opportunity in small town America. So my brother, being in essence a professional networker, is going to be the man who speaks the most tonight, hopefully. And I'm certain that we all have a lot to learn. And also, there'll be jokes. Hopefully, I'll be funnier than I am right now. Anyway, Ben, take it away.
I don't have much of a thesis. Just so everyone understands, I don't really come to these things prepared. I try to make it up as I go along. I do believe that our audio should be better this time. We have a professional on the case.
Yeah, welcome Ray Titus. Our professional
audio person.
Our producer.
Who hopefully doesn't get raided by the FBI for being on the show.
Yeah, and also, I guess, who's angry I said his first name? Is that right?
No, I just hope we save this.
Oh, okay. We will.
Sounds great, guys.
Pleasure to have you.
Ray will be chiming in when we become intolerably long-winded. And will be otherwise, he has a lot of knowledge and experience with audiovisual thingamajigs, and he worked in Los Angeles as a guy with the audio stuff. I know I saw him like Bill Cosby.
Okay, right now I think this is where you're becoming overly long-winded.
Okay, yeah. No. Anyway.
Well, so...
You had me at hello.
You had me at hello. Hello.
Don't talk about what we do tonight.
First rule about Oh No, It's Ranieri Brothers is you don't talk about Oh No, It's Ranieri Brothers.
And like with that, the podcast is over.
And just like Fight Club, everyone goes against that rule. So it's obviously business in general, as I mentioned, the first podcast is near and dear to my heart. I do sales and IT consulting for a small business out in Maryland that covers kind of most of the country and some international business. I also do small business consulting on the side for both IT sales and marketing general growth aspects. And I've helped a lot of small businesses start or bring about growth opportunities for themselves in our small town, which shall not be named because we don't want you to move here. We
have a lot of roofing companies. And that's true. It's unusual.
It is a little unusual. The cool thing is that you can take a small, take any small town that's like an hour out from larger metropolis or even just larger areas than the small town itself. And you can create a small business in a small town for that town. And then as you grow, you have opportunities outside. And so, yeah, go ahead, Tom.
No, I just wanted to pop in and say, like, one of the things that the internet has allowed for, which has allowed for someone like me to exist, is, where most of my clients are up in Northern Virginia. So I do most of my work, virtually. And so, like, you could even start a thing in a small town, but work virtually for bigger clients if you're able, bigger or more city-oriented clients, if you have those connections, which, is much less difficult than I actually originally had thought it was going to be. Getting clients, you just need to get the right personal attitude. You need to be able to present correctly, and obviously you need to be competent. But once you have accomplished those baseline things, people see that and like, okay, great, this guy can handle it. I don't want him,
right.
And then they take over. But anyway,
No, it's just one of the nice things about COVID was the realization, just being able to start a business or to work in a company remotely. That was always the case, that this was a possibility and easy to do. But, you know, when you started your law firm, you know, in our small town, for Virginia clients, the, you know, you people were already comfortable with the fact that, you know, virtual was okay. You know, they didn't have to be constantly meeting you in person, et cetera. That was always the case, but COVID made it mandatory for a lot of people, unnecessarily, because it's a sham. But
COVID actually happened, but...
Yeah, no, no, right. But the level of worry was ridiculous.
It's hysteria.
Yeah, hysteria. The but it, you know, it brought about a lot of good things. One, it showed you who was on what side by who wore masks throughout, like, even past the point of, like, stupidity. And then also it brought people to a point where they can work virtually. One part of this that is – and this is something I want to make sure I talked about is the tax ramifications of that. Because before, you know, you'd start a company in your state that – it didn't actually need to be in your state. Like, you have a website marketing company or digital marketing company or, oh gosh, any number of, like, it doesn't actually matter. It's not tied to where you're doing work, but it can be a multi-state type of company that you don't have to open your company's LLC in that state. You can pick a state with lower business tax rates. Like, what, like, for instance, Virginia is like 30%, but Wyoming is 15%. And you open an LLC in Wyoming, and but you're marketing your services to any state you want. So you're a digital marketing company, you're doing websites for people in Pennsylvania, Texas, California. Like, it doesn't matter to be there, you know, to be in this specific state that you're doing business.
As an attorney, my first thought is, like, okay, so you're not going to get that corporate tax rate in Wyoming, but your income tax is where you reside. So you're going to get the income tax. If you realize profits from, say, Wyoming LLC in Virginia, and it's because it's an LLC, it's basically a pass-through entity, you're going to still be paying Virginia income taxes on that.
Great point, Tom. Not if you have a holding company of that LLC and your holding company receives the profit. And
I'm sorry, you need to tell me more about that.
So the idea being is that you as a person don't need to own your LLC. Your holding company can own your LLC.
Right. There.
Yes, yeah. Granted. All right. And that LLC could be in Virginia and then your holding company in Wyoming. All right. And your current company in Virginia, your LLC, spends money, makes money, but all of the profit goes to your holding company. All right. And then it doesn't pay you, and it doesn't pay you as a W-2 employee over much. It gives you the bare necessities that you need to live, and then it pays for aspects of your life that you need to function. So, or spreads it out into benefits. So it fully funds your IRA, fully funds your 401k, it fully funds your children's education. Depends on the operating agreement.
So, but yeah, but it sounds like what you're saying is that, yes, you know, you regardless of whether you have a holding company or not, you know, you will get taxed if you take the money as income. But
right.
If you use the holding company to pay for business expenses and to pay for already pre-existing tax deductible and financial instruments that have been defined by the federal government, like your Roth IRAs and your IRAs, then that's fine because
and you're not going
to
be taxed on
that until it gets taken out.
Right.
So that that makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah. So let's say you're starting a new business and you maybe you're only making in revenue like $150,000, and then you take all of the sorry, we're getting notes here and I do not understand them. It looks like a D-pad on a laptop.
Ray, why don't you just speak up and say what you want to say?
No, absolutely. Just based on what I'm listening to, gentlemen, we have four ideals. We're starting. What are we starting? What class are we starting? We want to start law. We want to start a class society. We want to start what? What kind of class? Class, what kind of law?
When you say class, what do you mean?
Who are we talking to? What's the demographic, Joe?
Oh, okay.
Audience, you mean?
No, thank you. All right. Yeah. So first off, I'm not encouraging anyone to start a law firm or to get in law. Period.
That's why the business.
We're talking about starting a business in a small.
What kind of business?
This applies to any business. That was the point.
Well, I want to bring that up.
I should have mentioned that it is a universal. There are ways. So like the reason why. You know, there's a lot of these incredibly wealthy people. They have generational wealth, and they have generational wealth because
they have generations in wealth.
No. They don't receive a lot of money. They don't get taxed, and the way they do that is they play the corporate tax game, and they fully fund everything, and they put the profits of their companies into other assets that might make them tax deferred income.
Can I actually make a point that's corollary to that point?
Yeah.
But I still think it's important for people to hear. When you consider the amount of money that rich people spend on lawyers, which is a considerable amount, and when you consider the amount of money it costs to have a transactional attorney or a tax attorney set up your finances such that the ideal that you are talking about is realized, the amount of money they spend on lawyers, which is in the tens of thousands of dollars, pales in comparison to the amount of money they're saving by using those lawyers.
Right.
Otherwise, they wouldn't do it. But it's important that people hear it that way so they understand how valuable that rich people consider or wealthy people consider, you know, okay, partly making a pitch for good lawyers, right? But I'm also saying, like, look, you know, the amount of money you can save by spending money on the front end and with people who know how to take advantage of this. Take advantage isn't a good word.
It's taking advantage of a system that already exists.
I suppose.
It's all legal.
No, I know. That's my point. It's because it's all legal and it's all based on economic theory of, like, incentive and disincentive, that it's not taking advantage of the system, which implies that you're somehow pushing it beyond what it should be, but instead it's just using the system that in the manner in which it was intended.
Right, but you're learning the systems that exist. Like, it's all about educating yourself, because most of the time, most small business, most medium business, don't understand how the extremely wealthy have stayed and are getting extremely wealthy. And I'll get to how this applies to small towns specifically later, but right now this is just generally speaking any business, including those in a small town. And so, you know, taking advantage of what the wealthy do now is important, especially as they try and change rules. The more you learn about it, the more you guys do it.
It's important for small business owners to understand what options are available to them beyond the obvious things that they already know that will allow them to grow wealth in a way that they are unable to, that they haven't done it, and doing so in a small town, because all of the financial instruments and all of the, you know, the banks and everything, you know, they may be smaller, they may be less powerful, but they have fewer people asking for money.
Yeah.
And this is part of what I wanted to, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Okay. What I wanted to talk about was, not our small town necessarily, but the fact of the matter is that small towns are wide open for economic development. There are the people living there. There's certain place. I mean, like, obviously some towns are dying. They're, you know, they're hopeless causes. You can't go there.
Yeah, there's tombstones.
But at the same time, there are towns which are economically distressed. But the reason they're economically distressed is all the brain power has been sucked out of them. They have no one to put together that project. They have no one to put together the proposal to go to the bank to make businesses happen. And they have no one talking to them, right? Like we're trying to do now.
Yeah.
About not only how to do it, but the attitude you should take and the issues that are going to be, you're going to be influencing your decisions and problems you're going to have to be facing.
Well, right. So let me stop you, because I think I'm losing you. But like what you're saying is that small towns are open, there's opportunity, and that a lot of small businesses in small towns don't realize the wealth of opportunity to them in small towns.
They're unsophisticated.
Sure. Granted. But I'm also going to state that even those in larger towns, actually most companies, most people are unsophisticated about how to do business.
Perhaps that is. That's true. But here's the thing about someone in a bigger town or someone in a city. They're around other people who know about it. They're much more likely to learn.
Sure. Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
Okay. So I don't want to belabor this, and especially because, like, for instance, the finance aspect. I wanted to mention it. People can learn. They can reach out, whatnot. Happy to help where I can. I'm not an expert. I rely on other experts because I'm not going to spend all my time on business structure. Yeah, exactly. Well, Anderson Business Advisors, there's a law firm, CPA, and a bunch of other things all in one. If you're able to pay their amount, they'll save you millions if you're making millions.
Right. And so the whole point of what we're trying to get at, though, is that there's a lot of money to be made in small towns that will, by starting a small business and the advantage of it, of the local financial and banking institutions being underutilized by the populations, they want businesses to be started because it makes them money. And so if you go and do that, what we're talking about is giving you some of the tools, some of the mindset, some of the challenges and all the things that you'll need in order to move ahead with that.
Right. And to that point, that's bringing up two things that I want to go through. Like, you know, why do these things at all? Which is, you know, you're going to obviously be a more successful business owner. You're going to have less work for yourself, to be honest with you. You're going to make more money, but more importantly, you're going to help the community you're in. You're going to build up your own community. You're going to employ more workers. You're going to do a better job. Let's go a little bit further. Let's take this opportunity of the small business, small banking world. Like, banking relationships, people think that those are done. Like, they don't think you can just walk into a bank, talk to a banker, get a loan, whatnot. The honest truth is that it is still a thing. And it's still a thing on two levels.
Well, it has to be a thing.
It is. Well, so like, one, you should be really good. You should have really good relations with your branch manager of whatever bank you're doing. And there's tiers of banks, by the way. There's tier one, tier two, tier three. You should have your tier one banking relationships. Those relationships are built on algorithms. And there's more on that later. Look up the Get Fundable podcast. It's a phenomenal podcast to understand credit, business credit, et cetera. And that is, you know, that's a relationship with a bank based on an algorithm. That algorithm is based on, you know, your credit worthiness and credit history. But then there's another level of banking. Oh, by the way, small digression. Tier one banks are Wells Fargo, Chase, Bank of America, and Citi. And those are the only tier one banks. And you are, and the amount of weight you have on credit is based on whether or not you have banking relationships with those tier one banks. And then the tier twos are like the BB&T, the PNC banks, and things like that. Oh, sorry, Truist.
I use Truist.
I do too.
I like Truist.
I also have a bank account with Bank of America, TD Bank, which is another tier two, Chase, Wells Fargo, and Citi.
Then Warren Buffett, what are you doing talking to me?
Yeah, I'm working on things. But like, it's all. And then the branch manager aspect, like talking to your branch manager, they can push through business lines of credit, business credit cards, accounts, etc. Even though their system doesn't want them to, they can make a case for you. They're your advocate.
They can push it through.
But there's that personal relationship in a small town.
So that's good, actually, that you mentioned that, because that's a good segue to the next idea, which is networking. And how to network in a small town, you know, because in large part, right, networking is, it seems really simple. I know that I really have a hard time with it because, I mean,
that's surprising.
I'm very outgoing, but if I'm not the center of attention, I'm like less than
that. Oh, yeah. That'd be a problem.
It is. I mean, I'm working on it. I'm trying to get better, but it doesn't change the fact that I'm like, you just met me, right? Like, why the hell should you care about me or what I'm doing or anything?
Well, you represent a potential. you represent an opportunity to them. So they immediately care about you because they're not thinking about what you can give them. They're thinking about all the people you know that can give them. So networking and sales. So first, like, as far as tactics go and as far as, like, understanding how to act in either sales or networking, it's a listening game. Listen 20% of the time. Sorry. Oops. Listen 80% of the time. Talk 20% of the time. Ask questions. Questions should be almost... You know how we were always told don't answer a question with a question?
Yeah.
That's a lie. You should almost always answer a question with a question unless you've taken it too far. And then right before that cusp, and you can tell by their facial expression usually or their tone, you answer them. But you should always preface actually giving me an answer. So, for instance, Tom, let's say we met at a networking event. You're a lawyer. I'm an IT provider. I do IT support for law firms, let's say. I don't want any law firms. I hate them. Love you guys. Well, I'm sorry, guys. You're cheap. And, by the way, you're high maintenance. I can take a 5-person law firm that costs me as much time as a 40-person any other type of company.
We are kind of prima donnas in that way.
Once again, all right, so all right, yes, you are prima donnas that way. The reason why you want to network, just to give a little bit of context here, is networking provides connections that can provide business or business assets and resources. So you might go to an in-person networking event or a virtual networking event or a political event in your small town. And these provide resources that can help your business grow, help you gain information that you wouldn't necessarily have to identify opportunities, to capture opportunities, etc. Networking is powerful. The more you have, the better it gets. And in a small town, it's absolutely essential because everyone knows each other in a small town. So you have to become friends with people in a small town. You have to you have to be involved politically. You have to choose that party, whatever makes sense for you, and then be active within it, because almost always the large connections in a small town, the important people, are doing things in politics because it has an impact on them and their businesses, which means it has an impact on you and your businesses. So going back to networking, which is going to be a large portion of our conversation tonight, let's take an example. Let's role play. You're in a networking event. You meet me and you want my IT company as your client. And I'm thinking, as a law firm, I do IT support for law firms.
But you don't.
No, not realistically. This is role playing.
Okay.
So it's, you know, like,
where's your leather costume?
Yeah. I was about to say, throw on your hood. Let's go, Magi. Let's come on. So go. You come up to me. You're in a networking event. You have a drink in your hand. You're having a good time ish because everyone's talking, you know, you're talking a lot because you don't understand what networking is.
Well, I do what I would normally do with you. You can tell me. All right. Well, first of all, are you with someone or are you by yourself?
I'm by myself.
No, he's with me. I showed up. Okay. I played in the golf tournament this morning.
Okay.
So this is the after party golf tournament. All right,
fair enough. All right, so y'all are talking.
Yeah.
All right, so I come up to you, I put my hand on one of your shoulders, and I say, hey guys, what's up? Is there room for me in this little conversation?
No, he usually goes, how you doing? I'm Tom Raniere. I'm with X, Y, and Z.
No, I want to hear what he does.
No, I'm saying, and this is how I do it. How would you know how I do it? You're the receiving network.
I don't know, but I would go, who are you?
You're giving me advice, and I'm over here trying to say how I would do it.
Now we're on a path.
I'm more than welcome your constructive feedback, but let me play act myself or my brother.
Let's start over again. Hey,
I walk in to you guys, and I say...
So we're friends.
Y'all are friends. Y'all are talking.
You work for Company X.
I walk up and I go, hey guys, what's going on? You look like you're having a good time. Do you mind if I join this party? Kind of thing. And then you would say,
no, come on.
What kind of party are you looking for?
I would say, I want cocaine, and you're a jerk.
Well, I say, no, come on and join us, you know. So, what brings you to this party?
I really like wearing plaid.
Well, that's understandable. That's kind of cool. So, other than wearing plaid, you know, have you found any good connections while you're here?
I don't know if you want me to, play this straight.
Yeah.
Okay. I might say, well, I met that I met this you know, lady over here, and she was telling me about how she did X, Y, or Z, and I met, you know, this guy over there, and he told me that, you know, his job is
X, Y, Z, ABC.
ABC.
Well, you know what, Tom? I'm sorry. I asked me, but I don't know what you do. What is it you do?
Professionally, I'm an attorney.
Oh, that's awesome. Actually, I know a lot of attorneys.
Do you carry your business cards in your left pocket, or do you receive them in your right? Because you would have known those two people in the parking lot.
Going back to what we're talking about.
I don't understand.
All right. So, I know several attorneys. What type of law do you do?
I'm a complex commercial litigator, trial attorney on civil matters. So I handle things like business against business, litigation, employment litigation, asset purchase agreements, operating agreements, corporate governance, things of that nature.
Oh, neat. That's really cool. I've run into some of those things in my own business world. Do you have a business card?
I certainly do, yes.
All right, may I have one?
Well, let me look at my left or right pocket here.
Yeah, right. So you then give me a business card. Hey, Tom. You know, Tom. Thank you for that business card. Let me put this in my left pocket.
Look at the next.
What are you hoping to gain out of this event tonight?
See, I feel like you're trying to trap me. That's what my immediate reaction is. This guy's trying to trap me, and so my reaction would be, I'm telling you how I react. Is
I feel like you're trying to trap me.
No, I wouldn't say that. Why would I say that?
That's awesome, because that would be what is called a
reaction.
It's called a pattern interrupt. When you respond with something that they're not expecting.
Oh.
Which is usually honesty. Yeah, so honesty, which is one of the best pattern interrupts, is when you throw somebody off with an honest answer or with something they're not expecting. For instance, if I'm selling you something, you're not expecting me to say, I don't think we're a good fit for you.
But your eye will tell you judgment and investigation. And it will happen so fast.
I still don't know where Ray's going. I feel like there's a peanut gallery. But I'm curious about where you're going with
profile.
That.
I believe it's a profiling natural effect. Who are you? Who am I? Da da da. What am I doing? How am I? Where am I? How? And I think it's a computing factor.
Right. Okay. I see what you're saying. So what you're saying, Ray, is that basically people expect certain amount of questions, certain type of questions, and to be able to give certain responses. What we call the DC intro, which is, hi, my name is, what do you do?
Right.
It was like, that was that. What I do in networking events when this happens is like, I effing hate the DC intro. Yes, I do want to know what you do, but you know what? I more care about what will make this night successful for you and how I can make that successful for you. Because if I can grab him and go introduce him to somebody else, how much more of an impression does that make?
Yeah, but isn't that a little intense? Because aren't you going to turn some people off?
It's only intense if you don't have a reason why you're there. Most conventions, you're with a party, you're with a team. Is it your first time? Is it what room are you in? What floor are you on? Did you check out the buffet? Because that creates the natural, relaxing, neutral energy that you A, have a sanctuary, or you're going to go out and try to talk to the wolves, which come in as form of a little business card that you put in your right pocket that'll end up in your door sill by 10:30.
But what he's saying, as much as I don't agree with the details, I do agree with the spirit of it. The spirit of it is...
Cognitive experience.
The spirit of it is confidence. I am confident in my current situation to be able to make you introductions. Now, if it's your first time there, maybe this is the thing you do, but you know what you could do is instead in that networking event, you could be like, So for instance, like my clients are government contractors. So I go to a lot of government contracting events. These guys go to these events, not to find people like me, but find other government contractors they can team and partner with. Opportunities. Well, so when they say, oh, Ben, what do? Well, you know what? I'm the shark. And I'm here to prey upon the government contractors here that are stupid enough to talk to me. And that they're not expecting that. All of a sudden, they trust me more than they trust everyone else they talk to because they give an honest answer to a pattern or something they weren't expecting. And then I say, for instance, we do IT support, security compliance for government contractors. And geographically, we work in the DC metro area, but we can actually help anyone internationally. But you know what? You've heard people like me before. My thing's kind of boring. I solve IT problems. I solve security compliance problems and security problems and breaches. That's kind of boring. What do? And then now all of a sudden it's not the, hey, what's your name? Tom. Oh, what do, Tom? That's boring. Who cares? Everyone expects you to ask that question. Throw wrenches into the system. Make it memorable. And the way you make it memorable is as soon as you can. And you interrupt the pattern. And you go out there. But you don't do it in such a way where you slap them. Like, for instance, you said one of the first things you would do is you would go up to Ray and I as we were networking. And you put your arm on my shoulder. I don't effing know you. Why on God's green earth are you touching my shoulder? One of the first things I would do would be get physically defensive. I'd be like, I don't know you. You touch me again, I'm going to fucking hit you. All right. I'm pointing this out. This isn't just a teaching moment to you.
It's the F thing I'm concerned about.
Dude, we've been cursing on this podcast since the first episode.
It's okay, few and far between, because we are passionate. I believe passion is the key.
And it was, okay, and it was done in an example.
Continue. I'm sorry. Continue.
All right, and I can take that. The point though is that it's not that physical touch. Physical contact is yeah. Again, physical contact isn't completely unwarranted in a networking situation. It's you have to have a rapport with the person and you have to have the personality to pull it off. So if you must, then, in a networking event, this could be a political event in a small town. This could be a small networking event in a small town. Like BNIs are often that type of thing. Or it can be a large networking event, etc. If you made them laugh, if you talked to them, and if you're trying to provide them, like in a networking situation, whether it be one-on-one or an event, if the entire goal for you is find a way to help them, like you go into a networking event not to find, to get them to be your client, but you go to all right, what can I give you? What can I provide you? I can provide you this contact, this intro, and I get your business card. Now, all of a sudden, I'm giving you things, and then I can have a conversation with you about yourself.
All right, so that's great. One of the issues that I have a problem with since obviously meeting a lot of people, going to networking events, getting involved in your local community, such as in politics and a lot of other ways is a way of building your business, finding ways of connecting people. And as a result of that, business is going to naturally come your way. So we're cool there. Now, that being said, there are small fish and there are big fish.
Yeah.
And so for instance, I think that something we should try and do here is start an ammunition factory. So that is a big project. That's an industrial sized project.
Yeah, it is.
And I understand that would take a lot of doing.
Yeah, it's also the first time I'm hearing this, but go ahead.
I got an idea though.
Well, wait. I want to hear his question.
But if you show up to all functions wearing plaid, I think you can sell this.
Wow, plaid is plaid is unique.
I mean, every bullet is dyed plaid. I didn't realize, I never told you this before, but because the thing is, like, when you think about the shortage,
maybe you have actually
the shortages of ammunition, and you think, and I feel like I'm just giving ideas away to other people.
Well, no, but here's the problem, Tom. The shortages of ammunition because the federal government is basically, well, certain state governments and federal governments are pretty much mandating it. So you know that millions of bullets and ammunition are being destroyed. You know, it goes from California and shipped all the way to Hagerstown, Maryland, just to get destroyed. And that the storage before it's destroyed is taking up so much space that they can't handle storage.
I didn't realize it was that heavily regulated. That seems insane to me.
Well, that's California. That's California regulating it to the people, and then then shipping off the bullets to get destroyed. So it's not that we have. It's not necessarily that we have a short of ammunition. We have like we don't have. This would be taking on the man in a whole new level. Like it's difficult to do those things.
So instead of let's move away from ammunition.
Because that's heavily regulated.
Because really, what I'm talking about here is if you have a big dream, a big project, and I don't know how to go about this. I have some ideas.
Sure.
And I imagine you have some ideas. That's why I want to talk about it. Is because. I mean, I at least want to have an information sharing event where we discuss like what it looks like to put together a big business deal, big business plan where you start something like a factory or something really big that's going to be employing lots of people, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a large scale operation of any kind. And obviously you're going to need more than one person, more than two people. You need a lot of people to do that. At least I've been thinking that's true.
Well, for instance, let's take an easy example, right? A roofing company. A roofing company is, you know, let's say you're getting started off, you're $1.5 million, which is pretty small for a roofing company. You got three sales guy and you got like one roofing construction team. All right. And that's, you know, two, three sales guys. That's three people, roofing construction team. That's 5 to 8 people. And you're putting up like 10 roofs a day. You know, preferably. That's probably actually. I apologize. I'm trying because I know a lot of roofing companies, right? And there's a disparity between them. Like one of the ones that I know does about 30 million puts up 10 roofs a day. And then I know one that does 200 million, and I would assume they put up, you know, whatever the math is. More than 10 roofs a day. Or they sell them and never put them up. I don't want to go into that one. Either way, like you're providing a service, you're providing construction, you're providing a small business. A roofing business is easy in a small town if you have like a need. You're serving the community because you're putting up something they need. They need roofs on their homes. And then you're putting up and you're employing people as well. And you can satisfy that that growth need by your surrounding areas. But it doesn't have to be manufacturing. It can be services. And you can be serving, so you can be employ small town people from and train them on how to door-to-door sales, to find new roofs, and you can have 5, 10, like $20 million roofing company needs, you know, 40 sales, like 30 to 40 salespeople.
That's fine, and that's great, and I agree with you that there
are. I'm explaining the employment aspect of like a roofing company versus a manufacturing. At the end of the day, you know, $15 million roofing company is employing like 70 people.
That may be true, but like factories have a staying power, like roofing, you know, like the retail, the kind of retail businesses you're talking about, you know, they have the staying power a lot of times of a mayfly. Something like a manufactory like has a real presence and has a real impact on the town. And so you're right, you know, that there are plenty of opportunities for someone who wants to go to a small town and start a small business. But if you wanted to do something more, if you wanted to, like I do, want to begin to create something like a self-sustaining internal economy rather than being dependent on, you know, a large corporation that comes in and poaches workers or...
You need to create an export.
Okay, well, okay, fine. That, but still, I mean, I'm talking exports, imports, all irrelevant. What I'm
no.
What do I need to do in order to get the people? Who do I need to get on board with the idea?
Okay, so let's say okay. I see what you're saying. I think I was missing the boat. I think I misunderstood what you were asking. First off, you're working in town. Let's say you need the town council or the mayor on board. All right.
Then the county supervisors are so.
Yeah, maybe. But maybe all the power's in the town, not the county, depending on where you're at. And then let's say you need a county and the town. So you need to talk to the supervisors, you need to talk to the mayor, you need to talk to the town council. You need to get their input on what you're doing and whether or not it's a fit culturally for the town. Because if they don't believe it, not necessarily spiritually, but in a character sense, then they're not going to believe it when it comes down to voting.
So they don't like, basically you're saying if they don't like factories, you shouldn't even try.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so for instance, in our small town, they don't like data centers, like because we got burned and it took a long time for the data center to get approved. And then the data center did get approved and then it didn't get built because it was a
embezzlement, right?
It was embezzlement. Well, it was fraud at the very least. Now data centers, as far as the next two generations are considered, will never be built in the area. And so data centers are just off. They're just not going to happen. So that might be the case for a manufacturer in a small town, like maybe a Pennsylvania small town that still sees the wreckage of a manufacturer in their... You know, in their neighborhood,
domestic manufacturing is going to be coming back.
No, sure. But my point though is that you need the votes to get it approved. You need the small town. You need the community backing. And so it doesn't mean that you go to small town first. Maybe if you need to, you do a grassroots aspect where you're involved. You already have a successful business, not the manufacturing, but you have this vision. You want to do this thing. So therefore, you give and you give to the nonprofits. You're part of the community. You're on the Rotary Board. You're on this. You're doing, you know, you're maybe you spend a stint in town council. You vote something to help with the town. You ingratiate yourself to the community, the people, and you're honest about it. And you do a good job. And I'm not talking about this in a slimy way. I'm talking about this in a real way.
Authentic.
And then you're like, listen, I know this would help our community. This would be an export outside of our community. Other communities bring money into this community. We can build it up without tourism. We can build it out with anything. It's just our own ingenuity can be an export.
So what I'm hearing is if you want to get a big project done in a small town, what you need is, unlike in Silicon Valley, where all you need is an angel investor, right? Mm-hmm. Right. And you can buy whatever.
You need the people's will.
You need community buy-in.
Yes.
And if you're and the fact of the matter is that this is a great way of separating the wheat from the chaff, because if I'm starting a business in a town, right, mm-hmm. I want to start a business that's respectful of the people that are there and of their beliefs. And if I were the kind of person who didn't care about that and just wanted to make the most amount of money possible, you know, I would have to buy off these people. There's two ways forward. You're going to be authentic and work within that system and that within the confines of the community in which you're trying to build a business, or you can try and imperialize, in essence, to put a superstructure, an economic superstructure in a town or in an area that doesn't want it. You might still make money, but you're still a jerk.
Yeah.
You know, and
that's how utilities work most of the time.
Yeah.
I mean, like that's often how the utilities pay it off, and that's how they get there.
Yeah. So I think we've exhausted this topic. We move on to the next topic.
Well, we went from networking to kind of like starting a new thing, a new grandiose thing in a small town, and beginnings of that. Reach out if you want more info. Happy to take a free consult. But you know you know, a part, something I really wanted to make sure we cover today, because, you know, I actually received a decent amount of feedback on one of our first sessions on, you know, tactics and just understanding things that I think are common sense in business and sales. And what I realize is that there are certain aspects just stupidly. Well, sorry, I don't mean to offend anyone this time, but there are things that are very obvious, and one of those things that we talked about last time was, you know, getting paid what you're worth and getting paid, or negotiation tactics when talking about salary, or just certain aspects of talking to people. For instance, right here, like we talked about networking and questions, that's important in a networking setting, in a sales setting. So when it comes to small business, and this is not just small business, small town, though it applies here as well, and it applies to business consumer and business to business companies, is what are the most important pillars of your business? Actually, before I answer, let me ask you, not you, Tom, the law firm, but maybe you, Tom, the law firm. You might not know this, but just consider, well, just there's two pillars of your business, of any business. What are they?
Frank, honest, and accurate legal advice.
Think departments. You got HR, accounting, sales, marketing, operations, et cetera.
Okay. Litigation and transactional?
No, so this is a universal truth, whether it be a law firm or a software company.
And I'm sorry, ask the question again.
Two pillars. Think department-wise.
What are the two things that make my business work?
What make every business are the most essential aspects of that business.
Okay, that would be the producers, whoever makes the product, and then whoever bills and collects for the product.
Okay. Fascinating. Expound on your first response. So don't touch that. I want the first one, whoever produces the product. What do you mean? The people that are doing the thing that you're selling?
Yeah. It's like the thing that make. So there's two things. There's things that make money and things that don't make money.
Right.
Things that don't make money cost money.
Right.
So there's two types of people. There are producers, mm-hmm. and then there are cost centers.
So if you're producing something but nobody's buying it, is that now the most essential part of your business?
If I'm producing something and no one's buying it, I'm not actually producing something.
No, let's say you're producing product or service, but nobody's buying it.
Well, then I would go out of business.
Right. So is that then an essential part of your business?
Yes.
Why?
Because
if nobody's buying it, why is it essential?
This is insane.
Well, no, no, it's not. It's not, because think of it this way. If you have a startup, are you a company that is about to start up and you're getting investors, is it producing anything?
No.
No, but what is absolutely essential to that startup?
The value of what it might produce.
Right, and how do you get the value of what it might produce?
I have the foggiest.
All right, so these are questions that we could ultimately lead to our answer, but let me just tell you. Sales. You need to sell.
We have a crappy product.
Doesn't matter, because if you sell enough of a crappy product, well,
then that is a problem, because you shouldn't be selling a crappy product.
No, sure, but the essential
gentlemen,
aspect.
Throw a word in here. If you believe in a product.
Well, no.
Yeah, but you can lie to yourself.
That's part of the problem.
Then ask yourself the question, why are you invested or a part of the buyer?
Because it was making your money. But no, so my point, though, is that you have to be able to sell. You can go back and make the product better, or you can make it better going forward. But your business can only be a business so long as you're selling. right? It's essential. It's essential that you're selling your service or your product. Your business cannot continue unless you're selling that service or the product.
Yes, that's true.
Seven out of ten will fail.
I'm not saying
2% might give it a chance.
I'm not saying this is all unique. I'm not saying this is all unique. I'm saying that the two
essential things.
Yes. So sales is one. If we can agree upon that, we can move forward. We don't have any other questions.
No. It depends on what the second thing is.
Because You had it. Accounting.
No, but you... Okay. Yes. Okay.
That's what you said.
No. So from a...
Build and buy kind of guy.
From a purely mechanical point of view, you're right. But from a question, like an economic point of view of like, what are you adding to the economy and what are you getting paid for to add that to the economy? The question of sales and accounts receivable are corollary to the actual value. If you want to do it right, I get that there are people that create fake products or create ideas that people think that are believable or they invest in, like that chick who's now in, who's been the chick
Martha
that tried to do the try to pretend to be Steve Jobs.
You're taking an obvious extreme of selling a fake product, but there are plenty of companies that sell things that people need, but they're not the best product. Or they might even be a bad product. Hell, look at Adobe. No, Adobe is a multi-billion-dollar company, and they suck. But they have monopoly.
Those things are made out of clay, and they fall
down. Adobe Acrobat Reader.
I haven't found that for 5,000 years.
Actually, that would be better.
I think I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
If I may.
Yeah.
What you're saying is like there are different classes of products. If you're selling a middle of the road thing, your pitch has to be middle of the road. And if you're affordable computer, you're lower end, I'm affordable. I'm the best of both worlds. I'm the high power computer. And then the price changes as those things just, and as an attorney, the way I've chosen to run my law firm is, I put it all on quality, right? I want it all on quality. I want it all on quality, authenticity, and on personal relationships. And so that means I have a certain strategy. And what I'm doing is I am importing that strategy into what we're talking about.
Well, so, yeah, you're right. But I want to clarify what I'm saying is that essentially the things that make a business is money coming in and money going out. And that's sales and accounting. And it's not accounts receivable, although that's very, very, very important. It's accounts payable.
I feel like looking at it that way, you're just asking.
I'm talking about two essential pillars. I'm not talking about what makes up the entirety of a business. Like, and I'm not even talking about what makes a business be phenomenal. Well, that's why I keep saying the word essential, and we could go to like the dictionary definition if we need to, but like the most essential aspects, the base things are sales and accounting. Tom, the reason why I bring this up is because every fucking time I am consulting or I am dealing with my own stuff is everyone understands the accounting because they want to receive money,
sure,
and they understand the accounting because they don't want to pay more in tax than they have to, etc. But sales, what makes them money, is excluded entirely. That thing that is an absolute essential pillar to their company, to their business, what makes them money is excluded, is thrown in the corner, is given the smallest office, is absolutely just completely useless. They'll spend money on marketing. They'll spend money on HR. They'll spend money on operations. They'll spend money on fucking freaking anything, but they won't spend money on sales.
I'm sorry, because I realize... Because
you get a commission, you're expendable, and I can just give you a car and take it away and say goodbye up front.
Ray, you're killing me. I realize now that we're approaching this from two different perspectives, and I'm being a little bit too platonic. I hear what you're saying, and the fact that anyone thinks that sales is not like essential to any business, and having a person in charge of sales, because the personal touch, there's nothing that beats that, right? Like the fact that I talk to my clients and I say to them, I'm going to write this letter. I'm going to send this to you. I'm going to sign it. If you want to work with me, you sign it too. That I definitely feel that pulling people in, right? And when you ask what the pillars of the business are, like, you know, what I'm thinking as a professional is like, well, my work has to be on point, right? It has to be excellent because people won't hire me then. But I need someone to talk about how awesome I am.
Well, you also, like, before they can say how awesome your work is, you need to sell them. You need to get I know you're selling yourself, but what I'm stating is that before they get to see your work, they pay you. So it's not quality, it's your sell. You're selling, and then you're performing, and then you're, you know, and you're really, they're signing it.
You're right. I am selling a lot, so, but it is based on myself.
Yeah.
That's why I have a lot of unpaid hotel bills.
Yeah. But, and so my point, well, though,
who
is
you sell
that,
to?
Well, right.
We can't let
we're not, we're not going there.
If Ghislaine Maxwell doesn't have to do it,
Well, hey, put it this way, you are on the list.
Yeah. So, you know, here's the thing, brother, is that sales, accounting, are the essential aspects. Then you tweak from there. But the problem is that most people are like CEOs of their own small companies, 10 employees. They're doing the books themselves. They don't understand them, or they're not doing them properly, or they don't have a CPA that's helping them. Their CEOs are the best. Like when you don't have employees to sell, which is understandable, the CEO is the best salesperson, which means that he can't be the one doing it, which means that the thing that he most likely got into a small business to do, which is to do this one task himself because he was sick of being bossed around doing this one task, he doesn't get to do. He has to run his business. This goes back to E-Myth Revisited by Michael Gerber.
Well, this is Peter Principle, man.
Well, the small town HVAC guy, the small town plumber, the small town anything, or even the medium to big town guy that left, there was a technician in one aspect, technician meaning the person who did X, you know, like they did plumbing, they did for an employer, they did software development for an employer, they did hotel management for an employer, decides to go start their own hotel, start their own plumbing company, start their own software management development company. That person doesn't get to go and do the things they wanted to do without an employer. That person now has to run their own company, which means they don't get to do what they wanted to do. It means that they have to actually do the things that the people that were annoying them had to do, which is run the company.
And, you know, when you get that perspective in the first place, you
think
realize
you can do it better.
Well, some of them do.
But and sometimes that's actually true, that you can do it better. Not like they learn, but sometimes people just have a better aptitude. But the fact of the matter is that from, you know, when I said the Peter Principle, you know, what I'm actually talking about is the need for humility and business leaders, because business leaders, and it's understandable. You took something, it was you. Now it's you and a bunch of other people, right? You did something no one else or very few other people have done. That means you have a certain amount of pride, and you should, because you've accomplished something. But when that pride makes you think that you learned all that you can learn, or that you somehow, the very nature of the fact that you're a CEO, have now somehow absorbed CEO knowledge, like through osmosis, is not true. You have to repent of that and say, I now know I can run a business of 10 people. How can I run a business of 50? I've never done that. I need to know.
There's truth to what you say. I'm not sure that's all of it. I'll bring up one last piece to this, and that is, like, taking E-Myth Revisited, which I do believe is true. There are three types of people. There are managers, there are technicians, and there are entrepreneurs. And the myth is that entrepreneurs start most of the businesses. And that's a myth, because they're a small, tiny minority of the people that start business. Most of the people that start business are the technicians, the people that know how to do the thing, the plumber, the HVAC technician, who are like, I am so sick of being told to do other things other than the one thing I signed up to do. I'm going to start my own company so that I can just do the one thing that I wanted to do, the plumbing, the tech, the software development, whatever. And then they have a company and it grows. And all of a sudden, they aren't even allowed to do the one thing they wanted to do. They have to do all of these other things they were they didn't expect to be needed from them, and that they needed to
be all exposed. Of a
sudden to be, yeah, well, they.
Well, to be exposed, to new requirements, right?
Yeah,
it's being exposed to new requirements. You thought it was as simple as fixing,
just doing the thing.
Yeah,
right.
But
now you need to create processes. You need to manage employees. You need to handle HR, accounting, sales, all the things that you're honestly unqualified for. And then now all of a sudden, either A, you means you have to go back, or B, it means you sink and you screw up your life, or C, you flourish by learning how to outsource and to create processes to replace you.
And part of the issue there is learning how to trust the professionals that are on your side. Because a lot of times I've noticed that there's this instinctual sort of like, he's trying to make it easy for himself, or he's trying to trap me, or he's trying to do. An attorney wants, or should want, right? A good attorney should want to bring whatever the dispute is into the soonest possible conclusion, right? With the least amount of money spent. That's, in my view.
That's a great definition. Yeah. I just don't think many other attorneys agree with that definition.
But that's a good way of judging whether or not
sure.
It's a good attorney.
But how do you judge that before they hire you?
No, well, you can look at their track record, how they talk. I mean, I tell you what, we can go into
that would be really good. Hire a lawyer?
How do you hire a lawyer? Yeah. What do you look for? Right.
Actually, you know what? I don't think that should be a single thing. I think it should be how to hire a lawyer, how to hire an accountant. We bring on one of each.
Well,
You and an accountant.
Well, accountant would be a great idea because I don't know how to hire accountants.
No, but my point, though, is that I personally would never want to listen to an entire podcast about how to hire an attorney, because that would be almost as boring as listening to an entire podcast about how to hire a CPA.
Well, no, I mean,
but if you listen to getting how to hire both, you got, you know, two for one.
Well, I mean, okay, if you look at it from that small perspective, but if you look at it from another perspective, it's also a question of how to identify good people, how to identify bad people, how sure. Do you identify people you want to work with, how do people you don't want to work with, because lawyers you don't want to work with have all the same attributes as other people, CPAs or anything else you don't want to work with. So
to that extent, I'd happily go into how to bring on qualified people, whether they be an outsourced company or they be internal employees. That could be an entire another podcast that I would actually happily do, because I have hired and I have fired and I have learned things. You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. And obviously,
I don't know what kind of like the kind of circumstances I'm talking about.
Obviously, everything is very factually specific.
So why you would want to know about this, of course, is
a question for a later podcast.
Right.
Ray is doing a pantomime.
Yeah, I'm sorry. We're playing Pictionary with Ray.
Now, gentlemen, you are unbelievable, but I was trying to close in on the kind of circumstance why small town class would be engaged in law and starting a new business. How do we do it? Who do we need to talk to? And tell me how I can.
No, that's a great way to end this. Thank you, Ray. Although, once again, I don't actually appreciate your words you use. I like how you say them. And the essence of what you're saying. Listen, you want to start a business in a small town, find what your small town needs, or find a way to employ yourself in a multi-state way, and then bring on people in your own town that you can usher into supporting you in that business. There's multiple facets as far as legally structuring your business to pay as little taxes as possible. Bringing on outsourced help, feel free to reach out to us. Also, you know, you can look to your local attorneys, local banks, and local accountants to help you on the journey. But generally speaking, don't steer away from as far as banking is concerned, don't steer away from a tier one, tier two. I had mentioned the tier ones. I mentioned some of the tier twos. Create personal relationships and network with the political in your town, those that other people give a resounding recommendation for in accounting, in law, and in sometimes outsourced sales, business consulting. These people, they live on their reputation. So they'll do more because it means more. That's the great thing about a small town. Your reputation is everything. That's something you need to cultivate. And that's something you can also leverage against the people that you talk with and talk to in a small town.
So you should consider opening a new business, small business in a small town near you. And with that, I will say thank you for listening to episode 4 of, oh no, it's the Ranieri Brothers with the producer, Titus, who had a lot of feedback this episode.
And a lot of hand gestures.
As well as myself, Tom Ranieri, and
Benjamin Ranieri.
Thank you very much, and have a good morning, evening, or night.